Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel from the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, a professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. My guest today is Jing Vivian Jan, a professor in the Department of Government and Public Administration at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. She did her undergraduate degree at China's elite foreign affairs university in Beijing and got her PhD at UCLA. She specializes in comparative political economy, local governance, and development with a focus on China. We'll be talking today about her first book, China's Contained Resource Curse, How Minerals Shape State-Capital-Labor Relations. Vivian, welcome.
Thank you, Peter, for this invitation. It's my great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, very exciting for me, too. I don't know if you know this, but I studied at Chinese University of Hong Kong for a year a long time ago, so I'm kind of an alumnus.
Great to connect in this way.
Yeah. So first, why don't you give background for any listeners who aren't familiar with this idea or a little hazy, like, and it is kind of a hazy idea, actually. So like, what is the resource curse in general?
Okay. So basically, in the comparative literature, I mean, in economics, political science, there's this so-called the curse of natural resources. Basically, research has found that rich natural resources like oil, natural gas, or minerals are often associated with economic underdevelopment or weak non-democratic political institutions, and oftentimes countries with rich minerals also suffer high risks of conflicts and civil wars. So there has been a long debate about whether the rich natural resources mean a blessing or a curse to the host countries or regions. So that's basically this where this idea comes from, the curse of natural resources. So my book tries to investigate the so-called resource curse in the Chinese context.
Okay, so why don't you tell us more about, like, you know, what is the curse and what are some of the mechanics, both at the economic and political level that other people have identified in the past?
Okay, so actually there has been a lot of debate about the existence and the mechanisms of the resource curse. So like earlier, some economists find that natural resources actually hurt the economy. Okay, so like economists have raised theories like the Dutch theorem, arguing that the natural resources actually hurt non-resource sectors. Okay, and there's kind of a deindustrialization effect. So that's from the economic perspective.
So it's that story is sort of a crowding out story, like because there's so much money to be made from mining whatever it is, then you end up not developing any other industries. Is that the idea?
Right. Yeah, that's the basic idea. But of course, there are different mechanisms. Like it's about trade. You drive up the value of the currency for a certain country, right? So that actually limits the country's development prospect in many different aspects. So that's basically the economic story. But later on, political scientists actually added in, and they proposed more political mechanisms through which natural resources could hurt a country. For example, like there's corruption, right, rent seeking, and oftentimes the existence of rich mineral resources would undermine the quality of political institutions. So, of course, there are also a lot of debates regarding these mechanisms. And the third perspective, I would say, is from the social perspective, that is about the onset of civil conflicts and even civil wars, because mineral resources would arouse all kinds of grievance, and greed could also be one trigger for like contentions among different social groups, right? So that is why a lot of resource-rich developing countries suffer high frequencies of civil wars.
Okay, so in a sense, the two second and third options are kind of, they have the shared feature that, like, basically there's sort of, you know, literally in some sense, a pile of gold or diamonds lying on the table. And so rather than trying to build businesses or build the economy or build a functioning, you know, political system, especially in a less developed country, then everyone just starts fighting over these spoils, either or trying to get them. So either through corruption, if it's a relatively stable country, then it's just corruption. So it's maybe a little bit more like, you know, Russia right now. And then if it's a and then if it's a maybe weaker government, then you might actually have like rebel groups, subsisting off of these resources or trying to, you know, take control of the state so that they can run the state-owned petroleum fields and things like that. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you put it very nicely.
Okay, so all right, so that's kind of the big picture at a global scale, and obviously there's lots and lots of research that's been done on this in a lot of different countries and with different viewpoints about how each of these mechanisms is plausible and probably exists somewhere, but there's different opinions about how important each of them is overall and which one is at play in specific cases. So you studied this topic in China. So before we get into what you found, why don't you tell us more about like what you did for your research?
You mean the research method, or
Your research method, like what kinds of resources you used to? How did you go about investigating this topic?
Right. Okay. Actually, I used a kind of a mixed research method that combine qualitative fieldwork and case studies and statistical analysis. So basically, in the past decade or so, I have visited dozens of mining areas in China, including provinces like Shanxi, Jiangxi, Henan, and Inner Mongolia and Xinjiang, autonomous regions. So I have been talking to like more than 100 local officials, mine owners, and the local citizens to try to get information from different perspectives. I collected a lot of interesting stories through my extensive fieldwork. But on the other hand, I also try to generalize what I learned from the mining areas by conducting large N statistical analysis. So I collected provincial level data between 1999 to 2017 and conducted a regression analysis trying to test the different hypotheses that I derived from my fieldwork. And of course, I also rely on secondary data sources like media reports, official documents, and scholarly publications, etc.
Right. Yeah. With a big topic like this, it makes, especially the context of a book, it absolutely makes sense to, combine the, do the statistical analysis where you can, but make sure you get down there on the ground and talk to real people so that you understand the context from which those statistics are generated and how valid they are and what the, what the possible mechanisms might be. I'm always very envious of those of you in Hong Kong, because like it's so much easier for you guys to just pop up to China for, a few weeks or a month or something in the summer when you have breaks from teaching to do a little bit more field work, whereas it's you know, much of not it's not as bad as it used to be from the U.S. Well, now it is anyway. But even like before COVID, you know, even then it's like, you know, you still have to like fly over and deal with jet lag and all that. And so I guess it's no surprise you have certainly at Chinese University you have several great social scientists. You know, big group there. It's such a wonderful launching point to study China. Can I ask, how are things in the past 2 years? I mean, well, I'm curious how your field work went. So before we get into the topic, like how, in general, how did you find, you know, access, you're from China originally, and I don't know what your current, you know, citizenship status is, but like, you know, obviously that makes things a little bit easier, but like, how did research go when you did go and actually like try to talk to people, and did you see that changing over time?
Yes, indeed. Well, when I still remember my very first fieldwork related to this project actually was in 2009. How it was materialized, it was because of the university's service center. We all know it, right? So at that time, actually,
so for those people who don't, the University Services Center is based in, is it still based in Chinese University of Hong Kong?
It is, but now it's absorbed into
something else, right?
It's turned into part of our university library now.
Right. Anyway, just for people who don't know, that's a center that was based in, it's been based at Chinese University of Hong Kong for years. It's accumulated lots and lots of documents and data and resources from mainland China and been kind of a launching point and home base for many international scholars who are trying to understand contemporary China.
Right. So indeed, I benefited hugely from the USC. So basically, back in 2009, actually USC received a party secretary from one county in Guizhou province. So I got to know him, and he invited me to Guizhou province. And that actually was my starting point of the fieldwork. And actually, I also got to know another long-term collaborator of mine. So we actually got to do a lot of fieldwork in China. So he helped me arrange a lot of interviews in different parts of China. So that was how I could expand my network in the mainland and got to interview so many interesting people. So yeah, in this sense, the USC actually hugely helped me. So that was actually up to 2019. We know that in the past 2 years, because of the pandemic, actually Hong Kong has been closed up, and it's now very difficult for us to visit mainland China without a long-term quarantine. So now, yeah, it's a bit more difficult to do fieldwork even in Hong Kong. And I suppose it's even more difficult for scholars outside China to do it.
Right. How willing, when you did talk to local officials, how willing were they to talk to you? And how open do you feel like they were about what was going on?
I would say the vast majority of them actually were quite open. Partly, of course, I'm a Chinese, right? I can speak Chinese with them, and I can actually relatively easily understand their accents. Accents is something quite challenging for outsiders, right? But if you appear to be very understanding to them, and you can even try to speak their language, so they can be quite welcoming and open to you. But of course, there are also cases where local officials were not that willing to talk to you, especially when you talk to people in the police departments, right? Like in the public security systems. So that's kind of tricky. So you have to find the right way to ask the right questions that would interest them and make them willing to talk to you. And of course, sometimes it takes some kind of drinking, right? Drinking over banquets, that's essential. You have to drink with them to open up their heart.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a long tradition in Chinese field work, unfortunately.
Yeah.
need to get in there and ganbe with the cadres.
Right.
But yeah, certainly. I mean, honestly, yeah, it's probably for the purposes of China maintaining to the extent that the Chinese government doesn't want everyone to know everything that happens. They probably good that they're having fewer banquets and not having so many cadres drinking with international researchers. But it's been bad for our livers, but very good for our understanding of like what's really going on in China.
Right.
Okay, so yeah, so you've done a ton of statistical analysis along with interviews with a variety of actors at every level in several major areas. So now give us the big picture about China. I mean, I think most people don't think of China as a resource country. I think at this point it's importing a lot, and what natural resources does it have, and how important are they to the Chinese economy overall?
Okay, good question. So actually, China is a very resource-rich country. Actually, since we were young, we were all educated that China is so-called 地大物博, that means China has vast land, has a lot of resources. So actually, currently, China hosts more than 200 types of minerals. Okay, of course, the vast majority is coal. Okay, and some other types of solid minerals. So almost all of Chinese provinces are actively exploring and producing minerals. So the percentage of China's mineral production over in GDP fluctuated over time. At the highest point, I think that's around 2010. So the mineral industrial output took nearly 8% of the total GDP. That's at the national level. But if we look at the provincial level, some provinces like Qinghai, like Xinjiang or Shanxi, their mineral industrial outputs constantly accounted for about 20 to 30% of the local economy. So for these provinces, actually, mineral resources mean a lot for the local economy and the fiscal income.
So at the national level, we don't have it. It's nothing like, Norway or Russia, or Venezuela, where like oil wealth is everything. But you're saying when you narrow down to some specific provinces or regions of those provinces, then minerals become a huge part of the economy.
Right.
I guess it seems like, so the places you mentioned, most of them are sort of more sparsely populated and less developed as well, right? So is that also part of why, there's less, it's not like Shanghai. Like if you discovered gold in Shanghai, it probably still wouldn't be a big part of the economy because there's so much else going on. But if you discover gold in Qinghai or Xinjiang out west, then it kind of, it wasn't mainly gold, but coal or whatever, then it becomes a big part of the economy kind of immediately. Is that part of what's going on?
Right. So basically the coastal region, except Shandong, the other coastal areas actually don't host a lot of mineral resources. So yeah, minerals are widely distributed in inland areas. Some are actually quite populated, I would say, like Henan province. It's also quite a huge province with a lot of population, right? It also hosts a lot of mineral resources. But of course, Inner Mongolia or Xinjiang, which is less populated, yeah, they are actually mineral rich.
Okay. So you mentioned, it sounds like coal is kind of the main one that really is the dominant part of the economy in some of the areas you looked at?
Yeah, actually, coal is present in all of Chinese provinces. But of course, there's varying degree of reliance on it, like Shanxi province, and the Inner Mongolia. These are the major producers of coal. Yes.
Okay. So how is it produced in China? How does obviously China's in a transition from old style socialism to to whatever it is now. But you know, so it's not just central government mining activities. So what's the relationship between, you know, who owns the minerals, who owns the mines? How does that all work?
Right. So there is considerable change over the past several decades. We know that during the Maoist years, all the minerals were state controlled, right? So later in the 1980s, the Chinese government opened up the mineral market and allowed private or say non-state owned investors to come into the resource sector. But still, it took quite a long time for private owners to gain their share in the market. So I think it's since the late 1990s that we see more and more private owners in the mining business. But later into the mid-2000s, the Chinese government actually started to consolidate and merge the smaller mines into larger ones, and that actually allowed state-owned companies to take increasing share. So nowadays, we actually see quite a mixed picture. Depending on different types of minerals, we see different ownership structures. So for example, if we look at the oil and the gas industry, it's largely state-owned. But the coal industry, we see more non-state ownership. But for other types of minerals, we really have to look at into the details to distinguish different types of minerals.
How about in the rare earth sector? I know that wasn't really a focus of your book, but that's you know, attracted a lot of international attention for sort of geostrategic reasons.
Who
tends to run that?
Yeah, rare earth is a very tricky story. So I think in the past, I guess in the 20th century, the local exploration is quite chaotic. So that allowed opportunities for all kinds of investors to come into the business. But later on, I think the Chinese government tried to tighten the control over the industry and made it largely state-owned. But still, even among the state-owned enterprises, there's still a lot of competition and contention. So I think for a long time, the Chinese central government tried to centralize the locally owned rare earth mines, and there's quite some power struggle in it. But eventually, I think the center succeeded. And now I think it's some large state, central state-owned companies that controlled large part of the rare earth reserves.
Okay, and so how do they get the like let's just take the example of, let's focus on coal. So is it like some private company thinks there might be coal in some area or learns about deposits, and then does it purchase the land or purchases mining rights, and does it purchase those from the local government, like the local government, the province, or the central government? Like who is it actually paying for that, or who's have to work with in the government to get access to build, start its mine?
Right, that's a very important question. So the investors, they have to get the mining permit from the local government. So theoretically, I think it's the provincial government that controls the allocation of the mining rights. But in practice, the provincial government may delegate the power to local authorities. So yeah, I think there's a lot of variation across provinces and also over time.
Okay. And then they get those rights, and then they run their mine and make money and kind of sell their coal on the free market.
Well, actually, the coal market is not exactly free. There's still a lot of state control in various aspects, like transportation, like pricing, like depending on different types of coal. Actually, there are different levels of price. So still, there's actually heavy state intervention in the whole process.
But plenty of money to be made.
Yes, indeed. So like in the high time of the mineral market, coal mine owners can easily become millionaires as long as you get a mine and you can just lie down and get rich.
Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So it was a great investment. So now let's get into the theoretical framework of your book. So you identify sort of three groupings, which are in the title of your book, you know, the state, capital, and labor. I think traditionally, you know, people coming from maybe more of a Marxist perspective or an old school economics perspective might just think about, well, it's, you know, what happens to capital and what happens to labor. But, you know, I think you correctly, you know, identify in China, there's always an active state actor, and actually usually several. There's local government, there's the, you know, provincial and central governments, all kind of get involved directly. So the mining boom, not surprisingly, is good for capital because capital only needs to go places where it can make money. But what are the impacts on ordinary citizens in these regions that have a mining boom?
Right. So, well, I characterize the resource sector as pro-capital and anti-labor, mainly because I have seen so many horror stories for the local citizens and also the mine workers. So I would argue that the resource boom actually hurts the labor, which actually I quite broadly defined as the local citizens, not only those people who work in the mining industry, but also citizens living around the mining areas. So I would argue that actually for local citizens, they suffer from the negative externalities of the mining industries, including environmental damages, a lot of disputes, like economic disputes, land disputes, all kinds of disputes with the mining businesses. And there's also public insecurity, like there's oftentimes violence, social disorder in the mining areas. So in general, I would say the local citizens, they suffer hugely from the negative externalities.
Okay, so there, let's break down some of that a little bit more to make it more concrete. So you're saying they, in the local areas, what's the violence? Like who's fighting? I mean, if I come in and build a coal mine, how does that cause instability? Are there like miners coming in from out of town who, I don't know, get in fights with people, or what happens?
Okay, so good question. So especially back in the 1990s, when the resource market was not very well regulated, so mining rights often were distributed through violence, like the gangsters. Whoever got the power to control the mine, they got the mining rights. So there was actually quite a lot of contentions over mine control. For example,
you couldn't control that?
Yeah, whoever has the power to control the mine, they got the mining rights, right? They get rich, right?
Right. So, well, I guess I'm just curious. Like, I could imagine that would create incentives to, like, you know, let's say I'm in some county and there's a potential mine in that county, then I'd certainly want to, you know, bribe the county leader if I could, so that I would get the mining rights. But how would things get so out of control that, like, I mean, would there be like fights that between different, I don't know, if the local government doesn't give me mining rights, then are people attacking the local government, or are they, how's that working?
Okay, so let me give you a concrete example. I think it's back in 1994, there was a major clash between two groups. Both are investors who want to control the local gold mines. Okay, so they were like gangsters. Okay, they had armed clashes, and that actually led to dozens of casualties, and a lot of people died during that clash. So that was a typical example of resource aroused conflicts. So this kind of conflicts
where would the government be in this? Is it that were there like different like counties on the side of different groups, or they just were unable to exert authority?
I guess the local state capacity was quite weak, I would say. So basically, this happens in areas where there's very weak rule of law, and the local police is often captured by the resource capital. I would say there's a lot of collusion between the police officers and the gangsters who want to control the mines. So in face of such clashes, it often depends on which side gets more support from the local authorities, right? So oftentimes, in mining areas, we tend to see a lot of mafia-like groups. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they're kind of, this kind of free or easy money attracts gangsters and thugs, and they just kind of link up with local government and then sometimes get in fights among themselves over it. And then you said the other negative impact. So I imagine there's all, the usual, pollution and environmental externalities from sloppy mining. What about just jobs though? I mean, it seems like if people can, people don't have to work in the mines, right? If a mine opens up and offers a job, I mean, to take the hardcore free market point of view, right? Aren't they better off than whatever else they were doing on the farm before that?
Yeah, good question. Actually, if we look at the employment number, the mining industry doesn't employ a lot of people because essentially it's quite capital intensive, especially with the increasing level of mechanization. Fewer and fewer people are needed in the mines. So basically, the mining industries, they just don't hire a lot of people. And also, the mining jobs, they are not that well paid, especially considering the dangerous working conditions. Actually, I have statistics in the book showing the wage level in the mining industry compared with some other industrial sectors. So, yeah, mining jobs, generally, they are not well paid and they don't hire a lot of people. So for the local citizens, the booming mining businesses don't help them that much, I would say, in terms of job opportunities.
Okay. And there's no like economic, not a lot of positive economic spillovers, like just, even if it's just the local bosses getting rich, they're not like, I don't know. I'm just thinking about the California gold rush. I'm in California, and the story there is that the miners never got rich because they would work very long hours just to get, a tiny bit of gold. And then, but then the people who ran the businesses that served the miners and the rest of the economy kind of boomed because there were so many people there and so much economic activity. It was better not to be a miner than to be a miner, but there's no, you don't see any evidence of that in your statistics that there's kind of a spillover boom.
Well, actually, there is some kind of spillover effect. So the mining industries themselves do not hire a lot of people, but they do need to hire people for other related businesses like environmental restoration, right? So that's actually an area where the local governments and the local citizens, they bargain with the mining businesses, trying to get more jobs for the local citizens.
Okay. So tell me more about, so they don't get many jobs. They do have some negative environmental spillovers. Maybe they can, so it sounds like they can negotiate, or if they have a local government that is more activist on their side, it can negotiate for them, benefits from the, from the companies to try to extract some of that surplus. What else? How else do these resource booms affect governance or affect what the government can do for citizens?
So the state actually plays a very important role in the whole picture. It really depends on what the state does to try to strike a balance between the conflicting interests between the capital and the labor. So actually, in my research, I identify a two-pronged story regarding the state. So I actually find that on the one hand, there is a this is a kind of a collusive, or we could also, in a more positive way, say a symbiotic relationship between state and the capital. So the local governments, they do need resources to promote local economic development, right? So there's a lot of incentive for local officials to collaborate with the mining businesses to promote economic and fiscal growth. But on the other hand, the state is also very wary of the negative consequences on social stability, because we know that there's a lot of popular grievances and contentions between the mining businesses and the local people. So the state actually needs to do something to pacify the local people. So that logic actually affects the local government's public goods provision. So in this regard, I actually find a two-pronged story as well. That is, on the one hand, the local governments in mining areas, they have relatively weak incentive to invest in human development, because the mining businesses, they do not need that much labor, right? So the local governments, they tend to underinvest in public expenditures like education and health care. But on the other hand, the local governments, they, because of the frequent mining conflicts, they need to use redistributive policies to pacify the local people and to decrease the social unrest. So they are actually motivated to spend more on social security as a kind of safety net to pacify and to appease the aggrieved local citizens who suffered.
So what kind of social security payments are there?
Like social assistance, low-income assistance or pensions for those vulnerable social groups.
Mm-hmm. So rather than, if they have let's say $1 million of extra tax revenue they can spend, you're saying rather than using that to build better schools or maintain the hospitals or something like that, they will just give it to the the worst off people
We know that mining often involves taking away lands from the local citizens, right? So for those land losing peasants, how can they make a living? Where do they live? The local governments actually need to allocate certain revenues to find new apartments for these citizens, or giving them subsidies to cover their job loss, right? So through these ways, the local governments actually can redistribute the resource revenues to those people who lose from the booming mining industries.
Okay, so this would have a lot in common with what we see in Guangdong province or in the developing coastal regions, where there's, just for context for listeners who aren't familiar, so, no one actually owns their land in China, so the local government can always kind of exert an eminent domain and say, well, now your farm has been converted to commercial property, and, a source of contention is you convert it to commercial property and let someone build a factory on it, and they then pay the local government, millions of dollars, but you don't give, the person didn't own the land, so you don't give them, you know, you only give them a tiny fraction of that, or maybe something based on, if we had let you keep farming on this land, this is how much money we think it would have been worth to you. And the fact that we've, you know, rezoned it and made, you know, a lot more money doesn't, you know, doesn't affect you. But then people get a little bit upset about that because they don't feel like it's very fair, since they do feel some sort of ownership right. And so it sounds like it's a very similar thing. Like someone takes away my, you know, poor little mountainside farm and then builds a coal mine on it and makes a bunch of money. I get kind of upset about that. And then they pay me off a little bit.
Right. Yeah. The logic is very similar.
So it's all kind of negotiated. Are there any national regulations around that, or are there, but they're just kind of ignored, or how does that work?
Well, I don't think there are very detailed national level policies. It's delegated to the local levels for each province to figure out their own policies. And of course, the provincial government would allow the localities to figure out their own way of dealing with such problems.
Mm-hmm. So is the central government trying to does it seem to view this as a problem, or like, you know, how much does this kind of resource curse infect the central government?
I think the central government certainly is aware of many problems existing in the mining areas. So, for example, like the 1994 clash over the gold mines in Sichuan, it actually prompted the Chinese central government to revise its mineral resources law in 1996, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see the central level actually was responding to the local happenings, right? And later on, like in 2005, the Chinese central government required the local governments to try to consolidate and merge the smaller mines into larger ones. One major incentive was actually to decrease the local like mining accidents and all kinds of problems associated with the chaotic exploration of the mineral resources. So from time to time, we can see that the central government was responding to the local scenarios and trying to come up with policies. But again, the policies are still delegated to the local governments for implementation on the ground, right? So it really depends on the local levels' efforts to resolve many problems, and also their capacity matters a lot.
And this will also affect China's ability to, you know, work on climate change and carbon, right? If there's all sorts of little coal mines that keep springing up, I understand they've had some challenges even trying to, even when they want to reduce dependence on coal, it's been difficult for this reason.
Right, indeed. So when we look at China from outside, we tend to view it as a very strong central state, right? They have the top, so-called top-level design. But actually, in reality, the central government relies a lot on the local efforts to achieve a lot of its policy goals. So we cannot assume the central will can always be implemented, or to be realized in practice.
Right. So, okay. So zooming out from the China context. So, what do you see as the contributions of your book to, you know, the understanding of the resource curse more broadly? Like, how does it reinforce or alter how people or even just maybe highlight things that people studying other countries may not have thought about?
Yeah, that's a very important question. I have been thinking about this. So I think one major contribution that my book tries to make is that we need to look at the impacts of the natural resources on different social groups. So like in the past, in the existing studies on the resource curse, people tend to look at the host country or region as one unit, without distinguishing different stakeholders. So I want to draw people's attention to the different players, capital, labor, and the state. So I think if we are to discuss whether resources is a curse or not, I would say the better question to ask is, to whom is natural resource a curse? So that's one contribution. And the second contribution, I think, is I really highlight the roles that the state can play. So I would argue that the state actually can mitigate many of the negative effects of mineral resources on the society. But of course, the state has to have the incentive and the capacity to do so. So I try to propose this theoretical framework for future studies on the resource curse. So we have to really look at the triangular relationship between the state, capital, and the labor to really understand what's happening on the ground.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's a great place to stop. So thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. For listeners, this is China's Contained Resource Curse by Jing Vivian Jan. It's about how minerals shape state capital labor relations.
Yeah, thank you.